German panzers, but rather anti-tank guns and the Panzerfausts. If the reputation of a tank rests on its ability to support infantry rather than overcoming enemy tanks, then the Sherman proved invaluable, a fact that was never fully appreciated during and only rarely after the war. Americans should have entered the war with well-armored vehicles. After all, despite not producing tanks in World War I, the United States had invented the idea of assembly production of tractors and automobiles. No country was more familiar with the internal combustion engine than America. When the war broke out in September 1939, the still-neutral Americans had over 2 years to learn from the strengths and weaknesses of Blitzkrieg. American strategists noted that French tanks were well-armed and well-protected, but lacked cohesive tactics, radios, mobility, and reliability, while the German PZ-KPFW-1-3 tanks were wanting in the former and yet formidable in the latter characteristics. The Americans fulfilled their hope of at least entering the fighting with tank superiority, an impressive achievement given that in 1940 there had been only 440 obsolete tanks in the entire country and a mere 330 new tanks produced that year. In just 2 years, the Americans would build tanks at a rate of more than 20,000 per year and go on to produce more tanks and general armored vehicles than any other nation. In addition, the new Sherman M4 that appeared in late 1942 at the Second Battle of El Alamein was felt to have easily matched the undergunned, under-armored, and unreliable German PZ-KPFW-1-3 models in a way that the British Churchill, Matilda, and Valentine models had not. And the Sherman was a vast improvement over early American light M3 Stuarts, medium M3 Lees, and Grants. The Sherman's 75mm short-barrel gun was a practical dual-purpose cannon. It had long-barrel life, proved ideal for high-explosive rounds against infantry, and with anti-armor rounds was superior to the existing 50mm gun of both the upgraded PZ-KPFW-3 and the PZ-KPFW-4. At a little over 30 tons, the Sherman was heavier than the early model PZ-KPFW-4, with roughly about the same amount of armored protection. The heavier Sherman was as fast and mobile as early German tanks, with a larger, more powerful, and durable engine. More important, the Sherman was more dependable mechanically and easier to maintain and repair than any of the German tanks. In many categories, radios, crew comfort, and ease of maintenance, it was superior to the Russian T-34. Unfortunately, such advantages did not always impress crews on the battlefield. The popular perception was that by 1944, Shermans, when hit by most German tank guns, had a tendency to burn up like Ronson lighters, albeit due more to earlier poor ammunition storage systems than to intrinsically inadequate armor or poorly designed gasoline engines. Yet, of all tanks, the survivability ratio inside Shermans when hit by anti-tank fire was not inordinately low. Of the more than 6,000 Sherman tanks in the European theater of operations that were knocked out, on average, one of the five crewmen was killed, one wounded, and the other three, 60%, were unscathed. Later applications of ad hoc armor and improved escape hatches likely increased survivability. Whereas the PZ-KPFW-4 would shortly be upgraded with more armor and a much-improved 75mm gun, the more versatile Sherman for 1942 and 1943 remained largely static, as if it had met armor requirements and could rest on its laurels. In most cases, the classical German 75mm tank gun, mostly known as the 7.5cm KWK-42L70, with a longer barrel and a more powerful shell, could usually penetrate thick armor at long distances in a way that the Sherman's 75mm could not. Yet other American strategic and tactical principles would explain why Shermans could survive against German upgraded PZ-KPFW-4s, Tigers, and Panthers after the Allies landed in Normandy in June 1944. Even if a superior German tank might encounter a Sherman, the Americans assumed they could rely on excellent support from heavy artillery, often in direct FM radio contact with Sherman crews, fighter bombers, and a nearby fleet of roaming tank destroyers. The latter were lightly armored but fast-moving gun platforms that supposedly were on call to race to the front to meet enemy tank advances, fire their more lethal shells, and then scramble out of harm's way. In fact, tank destroyer doctrine only made some sense by autumn 1944 with the haphazard introduction of the late model M36 Jackson, 1400 built, that replaced the lighter M10 Wolverine and fast M18 Hellcat with their underpowered 76.2mm barrels. The M36's 90mm high-velocity gun and new anti-tank shells could penetrate most German tanks at great distances. Yet far earlier, and far more effectively, the Germans had mastered the idea of using their more numerous 88mm flak artillery as anti-tank weapons. Later, when motorized as tank destroyers, Jagdpanzers, they proved even deadlier than the ubiquitous 75mm Sturmgeschütze III assault guns. By 1945, the heavier-armed Jagdpanzers were superior to most models of tank destroyers due to larger gun calibers and superior shells, far better frontal armor, better training, at least initially, and mostly because they were seen as supplements to rather than replacements for tank-to-tank dueling. Soldiers and civilians wondered in late 1944 where was the American tank equivalent of the P-51, the M-1 carbine, or the Pacific aircraft carriers that were not just produced in great numbers, but proved qualitatively as good or better than individual enemy models. The fear that American tank crews were literally roasted alive in their rare encounters with Tigers and Panthers spread a sense of depression among tankers. Outrage followed back home that was not necessarily predicated on strategic realities. Upgraded and jumbo Shermans, the M4A3E2 and later M4A3E8 models, proved only stopgap measures that on occasion offered tank parity. An American tank's best chance by summer 1944 in a tank duel with German armor was to catch a Panther or Tiger by surprise and then floorboard ahead to fire quick volleys at point-blank range at the sides and rear. A rare but not impossible scenario. General Patton once related such a Sherman victory. "Our tank had been coming down the road, hugging a high bank, and suddenly saw slightly ahead in a hollow to its right two Panther tanks at a range of about 250 yards. These it engaged and put out of action, then apparently charged to finish them, and by so doing uncovered three more tanks which it engaged at a range of not more than 40 yards. All the German tanks were put out, and so was ours." Patton may have been right about how Americans might find ways to knock out Panthers and Tigers, but usually in these rare tank-to-tank battles, the cost was far higher than Patton suggested, especially in France in summer 1944. During the First Army breakthrough battles in July and August, the 2nd Armored Division tankers had learned how to fight German Panthers and Tiger tanks with their M4 Shermans. They knew that the ammunition of the 75mm gun with which most of the M4s were armed, a low-velocity shell about 13 inches long, as compared with the 28 to 30-inch high-velocity 75mm shell of the Panthers, would not penetrate at any range the thick frontal armor of the Panthers and Tigers, but could damage the sides and rear. Therefore, the tankers had used wide encircling movements, engaging the enemy's attention with one platoon of tanks while another platoon attacked from the rear. They had suffered appalling losses. Between the 26th of July and the 12th of August, for example, one of 2nd Armored Division's tank battalions had lost to German tanks and assault guns 51% of its combat personnel killed or wounded, and 70% of its tanks destroyed or evacuated for 4th Echelon repair. The Sherman became an abstraction as the world's first modular tank, given that its sound foundation offered limitless opportunities for experimentation and variation, from rhinos that plowed through the hedgerows to funnies that swam and exploded mines. Sherman models were eventually upgraded with both a 76mm higher velocity gun and, more famously, the British 17-pounder, 76.2 millimeter 3-inch barrel, whose muzzle velocity and large payload could at last match the feared German 88 millimeter gun of the Tiger I and Tiger II, or the high-performance 75 millimeter Panther barrel. The American armor tragedy was the failure by the June 1944 Normandy landings either to have an upgunned model or to have fielded an additional heavier tank to supplement the Sherman and match the Tiger or Panther, and to have done so in far greater numbers. The United States could have produced at least a few hundred of the heavy M-26 Pershing tanks by mid-1944 had General Leslie McNair and other advocates of tank destroyers and light tanks not opposed the idea. As a consequence of this lapse, Sherman tank crews were reminded to avoid tank-to-tank duels. Most by late 1944 needed no such admonition, given that they considered Shermans with even the 76mm gun a death trap. A certain paranoia about meeting a rare Panther or Tiger set in among American crews, prompting many to stack sandbags to add protection to their inadequate armor, a habit that infuriated General Patton. I noticed that all the tanks were covered with sandbags. This was very stupid. In the first place, it made the soldiers think that the tanks could be hurt. In the second place, it overloaded the machinery. And in the third place, it added no additional protection. I ordered their removal at once. Barring the mass production of a new, heavier tank, there should have been more of an effort to replace the Sherman's main 75mm or 76mm gun with either a longer, higher-velocity barrel or a 90mm gun, an idea that was raised and then quickly dropped. As in the case of Britain, but quite unlike the Russian or German experience, all American tanks had to be transported by sea to the front, making shipping weight, handling, and offloading important criteria. All these problems notwithstanding, American armored forces in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and Western Europe ultimately defeated enemy tank and infantry forces. The United States prevailed in Europe because of ubiquitous and reliable Shermans that more often fought Axis infantry rather than enemy armored units. And when they met superior German tanks, Shermans could often rely on close air and artillery support. It prevailed in the Pacific, where armored thrusts were not a part of island and amphibious warfare, to the same degree as in the European theater. Shermans proved superior to all Japanese tank models and provided invaluable support in the major landings from Tarawa to Okinawa. Still, the rare but horrific encounters with German heavy tanks were such a searing experience for U.S. armored units that the Americans vowed never again to put their crews into a tank that could not easily outfight all enemy armor. That conundrum was not perhaps solved until the early 1980s with the emergence of the Abrams tank, which would prove clearly superior to its rivals for over three decades. During the first Gulf War, U.S. Abrams M1A1 tanks in the last major tank-to-tank duels of the 20th century helped to destroy well over 160 Iraqi Russian-built tanks in a series of engagements on February 26th and 27th, 1991, without losing a single American tank to enemy tank fire. It was as if the Americans had finally married the reliability of the Sherman with the lethality of the Tiger. The British invented the tank. Their pre-war theorists were among the most sophisticated advocates of armored tactics and independent tank units. Before the D-Day landings, the British, guided by Major General Percy Hobart, adapted the Churchill and, to a lesser extent, the American Sherman tank as a mine flayer and amphibious tank to a variety of ancillary duties, from bridging ravines and streams to flamethrowing and clearing barbed wire. When the American Sherman tanks in summer 1944 proved undergunned against German counterparts, it was the British who brilliantly re-engineered the lethal 17-pounder gun into a Sherman turret, creating the deadly Firefly and allowing an otherwise inadequate Allied tank force emerging from Normandy to obtain some parity with German Tigers and Panthers. Given such technical genius and experience, it was surprising that the British entered the war with mediocre tanks and did not build first-rate models until the end of the conflict. Part of the reason was that, like the Americans with their flawed concept of tank destroyers, so too the British clung to their own tactical fallacies, especially a dual-use system of tanks that complicated design and production. so-called infantry tanks, plodding, well-armored tanks with infantry formations that would blow holes through enemy lines, would be reinforced by faster and less protected cruiser tanks, which in independently operating units would rush in to exploit breaches and achieve encirclements. All this was too clever by half, and analogous to the flawed British naval idea of large, fast, and vulnerable battle cruisers like the HMS Hood and HMS Repulse, partnering with better protected battleships. In fact, even British cruiser tanks were often slower than their German counterparts, and their infantry tanks even less protected. Such bifurcation likewise retarded the idea of a single versatile tank being integrated with air support, artillery, and infantry to break through enemy lines. By dispersing British talent and industrial resources on a variety of designs, Centurions, Challengers, Churchills, Comets, Cromwells, Cruisers, Crusaders, Matildas, Valentines, and a host of others, the British failed to incorporate lessons from the battlefield into one standard model. It was not that British industry was incapable of turning out thousands of good tanks. At war's end, Britain's total tank production had reached nearly 30,000, quantitatively comparable with that of Germany's panzer output. There were other considerations that hampered initial British efforts to produce, by 1943, a basic tank comparable to the Sherman, the T-34, or Panther. Like the Americans, the British fought not only the Germans but also the Japanese, who never produced an adequate tank. As a result, there was less pressure on the British to upgrade their tanks, given that their earlier models were still superior to the Japanese light types that the British met in Burma. And of course, as in the case of the island Japanese and the North Americans, British military doctrine in general was not predicated on ground combat across borders, but rather on expeditionary forces whose transportation challenges favored lighter armor designs. Finally, after mid-1942, continuous battles on the Eastern Front had begun to sap German panzers. British and American strategic planning was beginning to be envisioned as a specialized zero-sum game. The huge Soviet tank force, with its tens of thousands of T-34s, ensured that the majority of first-rate upgraded PZ-KPFW-4s, Tigers, and Panthers would never be used in full force on the Anglo-American fronts. Assuming that by 1944 there would be a British battle tank appearing in quantities and quality comparable to the T-34 was analogous to expecting the Soviets to deploy thousands of four-engine bombers. In a way, for the British, the superb Lancaster heavy bomber was their version of the T-34 tank. By late 1944, they did to German cities and industry by air what the Russians did on the ground to German infantry and armored forces. In fact, British strategic bombing of German plants, particularly the near destruction of Kassel, probably did as much to reduce the presence and operability of German Tigers as did T-34 Russian tanks. The initial British infantry tanks, the Matilda 1s and 2s, despite their satisfactory armor, were equipped only with light machine guns or small turret guns. They were barely adequate against infantry. German 88mm artillery could easily blow apart the Matilda 2s at over a mile distant. By the time of the Second Battle of El Alamein in October and November 1942, most Matildas had been destroyed or worn out during the prior year of fighting. Faster cruiser Mark I and Mark II tanks, A9 and A10, also had little luck fighting German panzers and were built only in limited numbers. The hope for the newer Valentine tank was to restore British parity with the Germans. Although over 8,000 Valentines were produced, an impressive achievement that exceeded all German Panther tank production and proved mostly reliable, they weighed only half of what the Shermans did. Their 40mm and 57mm guns were inadequate, and their armor remained insufficient. Improved Cromwell cruiser tanks, 4,000 built, soon followed. For the first time, they seemed to offer the British an excellent all-purpose medium tank. Although they were slightly lighter than Sherman's, Cromwell's at least enjoyed a lower profile and more frontal armor than did early Sherman models. Cromwell's were extremely fast and mobile. Their new Rolls-Royce Meteor engines were reliable. Yet even with increased armor and a 75mm gun, they did not marginally supersede the American tank. Heavy Churchill tanks, 7,300 built, were rushed into deployment in late 1942. The Churchill's weight, 39 tons, substantial armor, up to 4 inches, and excellent suspension made it comparable to German later model tanks. But constantly upgraded Churchills soon proved underpowered. They were not as reliable or as easily maintained as Sherman's. Their armor was not sloped, and even their improved main gun, 75 millimeters, was not effective against Panthers and Tigers. The British finally reached parity with the best German models in late 1944 with the Comet, A-34. It fired the same caliber projectile as the Sherman 76.2mm gun, but was vastly upgraded with improved shells and velocity. The Comet's improved armor and Rolls-Royce Meteor engines made it in some ways superior to all models of the Sherman. The Comet, however, came too late with only about 1,100 tanks produced by war's end. And when the British finally mastered the idea of a standard universal tank with the superb Centurion, the first British tank that was clearly superior to both Panthers and T-34s, the war was over. The fact that the British received and deployed over 20,000 American Stuarts, Lees, Grants, and Shermans, a sum almost greater than all British frontline tanks produced during the war, was a reflection of its own inability for the first 5 years of the war to produce an adequate tank in large enough numbers to equip British armored divisions. But that fact, perhaps, was an understandable lapse given Britain's insistence on fighting in all the wars of World War II on and below the seas, in the skies, and across Asia, Europe, and North Africa, often in places where tanks were irrelevant. One paradox of armored warfare during World War II was that a vehicle designed to protect its crew from shells and bullets often became the focus of such overwhelming concentrations of fire that it proved as much an incinerator as a refuge. 75% of Soviet tank crews did not survive the war. Over 80% of all T-34s, possibly the best all-around tank of the war, were destroyed or disabled. It is easy to see why tanks proved to be death traps. Tanks had limited visibility. They were neither especially fast nor particularly mobile. They were relatively easy to spot and were targeted by lots of other tanks, anti-tank ground and shoulder-fired weapons, fighter bombers, mines, and artillery. They were hard to climb into and even harder to escape from. Early riveted models encouraged spalling, in which interior rivets dislodged to become lethal projectiles under the pressure of incoming enemy rounds. But the worst threat was the presence of stored high-explosive and armor-piercing shells and large-caliber machine gun ammunition inches away from an internal combustion engine. There were lots of ways to stop a tank. Blow it apart by another tank or artillery gun, destroy it from the air with bombs or rockets, have individual soldiers attack it with anti-tank projectiles or crude incendiary devices, lay mines and obstacles to block its passage, or simply deny it fuel. As a general rule, on all fronts by mid-1943, German tanks were not effectively stopped by Allied shoulder-mounted infantry weapons, unless the infantry was using captured German stocks, or even often by other tanks, unless they were updated Russian T-34s and Stalins. Neutralizing panzers instead required close air support, artillery, or disruption in German fuel supplies and deliveries. Or occasionally, by mid-1944, British upgunned Sherman tanks. The reason that the Russians lost most of the T-34s produced was not because of Soviet fuel shortages or mechanical difficulties, but rather because Luftwaffe fighter and dive bombers, Tigers and Panthers, Panzerfausts and Panzerschrecks, and 88mm mobile artillery all were especially effective against even excellent Russian armor. In contrast, the British and Americans relied mostly on tactical air superiority and a clear numerical advantage in artillery to meet the threat of German tanks. Modified Sherman Firefly tanks were produced in greater numbers than were the Tiger I and Tiger II combined. Over 2,000 Fireflies were sent to France and offered parity in rare tank-to-tank encounters on the Western Front. The Sherman Firefly proved a far more efficient investment in delivering a lethal shell to a heavy tank than were the huge Tigers. Amid the triumphalism of Blitzkrieg, few remembered that it almost always was predicated on air dominance and superior numbers, but otherwise was only possible for brief periods without reliable supply lines. Breakthroughs also usually required blunders on the part of the enemy to preclude timely retreat, or at least to mass on a narrow front with exposed and vulnerable flanks. Implicit to the success of armored encirclements was also finite area. Pity the poor enemy without the space to retreat before German armored advances in hopes that the panzers would outrun their supply lines. Rare armored dashes nonetheless might advance at rates of 30 miles per day and thereby, through shock, collapse entire enemy fronts. In their initial armor sweeps of summer 1941, for instance, the Germans altogether probably destroyed about 5,000 Soviet tanks. They may well have captured or killed 3 million Soviet soldiers and perhaps occupied territory responsible for about 40-50% of Soviet industrial production. In summer 1942, German armored forces of Army Groups A and B of Army Group South advanced over 500 miles and nearly reached the Caspian Sea, only to find their spearheads too far from supply lines and offering the Russians attractive salients for counterattacks. The German armored advances were almost always spearheaded by updated PZKPFW-3 and PZKPFW-4 tanks, but also assumed absolute Luftwaffe superiority, plentiful mobile artillery, adequate fuel supplies, better tank crews, and superior numbers. Yet note that the two longest and most successful armored thrusts in history, in southern Russia and North Africa, did not lead to strategic victory. Blitzkrieg ended in 1943 with the surrender at Stalingrad and later stasis at Kursk, not so much due to considerable German losses in both battles per se, as to the appearance of hundreds of new T-34 tanks each month, the end of Luftwaffe dominance, and the sheer number of new Soviet infantry divisions and artillery units. By latter 1942, the Eastern Front was costing the Third Reich 100,000 dead each month. In that year alone, the Germans lost 5,500 tanks, 8,000 guns, and 250,000 vehicles. On a lesser scale, Rommel and his Afrika Korps were to meet the same fate at about the same time as the 1942 German Blitzkrieg stalled at Stalingrad. The causes of these failures were hauntingly familiar, despite the vast difference in ability of the two respective senior commanders. Rommel, like Paulus, was forced to assume that German experience and expertise might still trump enemy numbers and material advantages, or that success in individual tank battles translated to strategic momentum. Instead, both German advances were again far from sources of supply. Neither had ever quite calculated how to be adequately provisioned with fuel, replacements, and food, even had they won, respectively, the landmark battles of El Alamein and Stalingrad. On the Eastern Front, armored vehicles often returned to their late World War I role of accompanying and protecting infantry advances or slowing enemy assaults. As both the Germans and Soviets continued to deploy better tanks to the front and were terrified of being trapped by mobile pincer movements, all the more did armored warfare descend into a war of attrition. Still, a few of the most dramatic Allied armored advances of the war occurred in its last full year, when Axis air power nearly vanished from close ground support roles, and Hitler's serial orders of no retreat to trapped armies gave the Allies new opportunities. The late July 1944 breakout of the U.S. First Army in Normandy, Operation Cobra, was predicated on massive bombing of the German front by the 8th Air Force. A hole was blasted in German defenses on two back-to-back bombing missions by 3,000 aircraft, marked by waves of 1,500 American B-17 and B-24 strategic bombers used for the first time on a large scale as tactical aircraft, with help from over 1,000 medium American B-25 and B-26 bombers and assorted fighter bombers. A second breakthrough occurred after the collapse of German forces at the Falaise Pocket and the cumulative destruction of some 40 divisions in the two-month battle for Normandy, followed by the mad dash toward the German border of Patton's Third Army for much of August 1944. Patton's unexpected breakout shared the same characteristics of Germany's early armor advances. Later, Hermann Göring, in his Nuremberg interviews, had that dash to the German border in mind when he stated that Patton was the most effective of the Allied commanders, your most outstanding general, and the breakout at Avranches the Americans' greatest achievement in the West. General Fritz Bayerlein, a Panzer Division commander in Normandy, in grandiose language, summed up Patton's armored thrust. Not even the battles of annihilation of the 1940 Blitzkrieg in France or in 1941 in Russia can approach the battle of annihilation in France in 1944 in the magnitude of their planning, the logic of their execution, the collaboration of sea, air, and ground forces, the size of the theater, the strength of the combatants, the bulk of the booty, or the hordes of prisoners. Its greatest importance, however, consists in its strategic effects, that is, that it laid the foundation for the subsequent final and complete annihilation of the greatest military state on earth. The German breakout phase of the so-called Battle of the Bulge, December 16, 1944, through January 25, 1945, worked for just 10 days, December 16 through the 26th. Given that it was predicated on achieving initial surprise on the superiority of a thin line of Tigers and Panthers on a limited front initially aimed at green troops, on bad weather that would ground Allied fighters, and on obtaining captured fuel. After a few days, all that proved too many ifs. Understandably, the German offensive quickly lost steam once the weather cleared and Allied fighters returned. Fuel shortages slowed the panzers, and the Allies got over the shock of surprise and systematically brought to bear their advantages of manpower and equipment. After the war, General Gerd von Rundstedt, still bothered by the fact that Hitler's harebrained scheme, Watch on the Rhine, had been popularly labeled the Rundstedt Offensive, supposedly was reported to have scoffed, "Von Moltke would turn in his grave at Hitler's military tactics, particularly his tactics in the so-called Rundstedt Offensive, which Rundstedt said should be known as the Hitler Offensive." Nonetheless, rare massed tank assaults against infantry that were not supported by comparable tanks or air and artillery remained an almost mythical combat experience, analogous to the rare unleashing of heavy lancers against retreating 19th-century foot soldiers. During the Polish campaign, German officers observed that numerically superior German tanks had such a demoralizing effect on enemy tank crews that they often jumped out or showed the white flag. Such a specter of unchecked armored blitzkrieg had collapsed not just Polish, Dutch, Belgian, and French armies, but also their entire war efforts. The battles that involved the greatest number of captured soldiers almost always followed from armored encirclement or an unchecked armored advance. The Battle of Bialystok-Minsk, June 22 through July 3, 1941, the Smolensk encirclement, July 6 through August 5, 1941, the Battle of Uman, July 15 through August 8, 1941, the First Battle of Kiev, August 23 through September 26, 1941, Vyazma Bryansk, October 2 through 21, 1941, Operation Uranus and the destruction of Axis forces near Stalingrad, November 19 through the 23, 1942, the Falaise Pocket, August 12 through the 21, 1944, and the destruction of two U.S. divisions during the first days of the Battle of the Bulge, December 16 through the 20th, 1944. Every great tank breakout at some point ran out of fuel. Partly this was because World War II militaries put far more emphasis on a tank's defensive and offensive capability than on its fuel consumption, range, and logistical transport. During the battle for France, German panzers often found themselves out of fuel and stalled waiting for tankers to catch up. The same was true after the first 2 weeks of Operation Barbarossa and of Rommel in his race across Libya into Egypt. During Patton's August 1944 drive through France, his Third Army had outrun its supply lines and his Sherman tanks ground to a halt. Patton's army alone consumed 350,000 gallons of gasoline per day. Collectively, the Allied armies in summer 1944 in France were burning 800,000 gallons per day. The entire German strategy at the Battle of the Bulge was predicated on capturing Allied fuel supplies, a gambit that only half succeeded and was not enough to keep the gasoline-starved panzers going. It was striking how both the Allies and the Axis accepted the dependence of tanks on steady fuel supplies, and yet how often both sides found their offensive sputtering to a halt due to gasoline shortages. Tanks had helped to radically change the course of a conflict in only a few of the many theaters of World War II. In North Africa, 1940 through 1943, and in Eastern, 1939 and 1940, and Western Europe, 1944 and 1945. In the first case, the coastal deserts, unobstructed terrain, clear weather, and sparse population proved ideal for armored operations between evenly matched British and Axis forces in periods when one side had not yet achieved air superiority. In the second, the good roads of Western Europe, rich infrastructure, and the short distances from border to border meant that it was less challenging to supply tanks with fuel and air support, and their crews with water and food. In contrast, the vast expanse of the Soviet Union, its primitive roads and general impoverishment, often meant that even huge armored encirclements did not always lead to enemy collapse, while the availability or shortage of fuel, food, and spare parts, not just armor and arms, spelled victory or defeat. Other than the British pursuit of the Italians in North Africa in late 1940 and the subsequent chase of Rommel in 1942, or the American breakout from Normandy in early August 1944, it is hard to cite the use of British and American tanks, in contrast to motorized infantry, artillery, or tactical and strategic air power, as the chief causes for the Allied success. Blowing a tank track off a T-34 with a Panzerfaust, a weapon that an American tank officer dubbed the most concentrated mass of destruction in this war, was a far better investment than building and deploying a 70-ton Tiger II to outduel a Russian tank. By war's end, heavy tanks were increasingly risky investments of capital and labor, the Americans and the Russians best squared the cost-benefit circle of the expense of tanks versus results achieved in enhancing infantry by focusing on just one or two simple designs, producing them in mass and at relatively cheap cost, and ensuring that they were reliable and easy to maintain. The great bloodbath on the Axis battlefields came in 1944 and 1945, when the Allies achieved tactical air superiority and were free at last to attack ground forces as they pleased. Germans suffered more military deaths just in 1944 than they had between 1939 and 1943, when the Luftwaffe had near parity with the Allied tactical air forces. Also, as important as the quality of tanks was the number of truck transports, fixed and mobile artillery pieces, the availability of machine guns, anti-tank weapons, mortars and landmines, and effective radio contact with artillery batteries. Despite the mobile nature of combat in World War II and the romance of armor assaults, the great killer of Axis and Allied soldiers remained artillery. The exact percentages depended on the year and theater of operations, but at least half of the combat dead of World War II probably fell to artillery and mortar fire. The paradox of both greater mobility and also greater numbers of men killed by semi-stationary artillery is probably explained by the sheer number of shells fired in World War II. Well over 8 million field guns and mortar weapons were produced during the conflict. With the death of the Blitzkrieg at Stalingrad, much of the fighting from early 1943 onward on the Eastern Front, the great incinerator of Axis and Red Army soldiers, turned more static in the fashion of World War I in the West, and often regressed to artillery, rocket, and mortar barrages aimed at fixed infantry positions. In some sense, the trajectory of World War II hinged on the side that placed the greatest number of artillery pieces on the field of battle. Each of the three major Allied belligerents produced more large guns than did Germany, Italy, and Japan combined. The most significant statistic of the war was the 10-to-1 advantage in aggregate artillery production, in total over 1 million large guns, enjoyed by the British Empire, the Soviet Union, and the United States over the three Axis powers. Over 1 billion artillery shells were produced in the United States alone. In addition, there were far more variety and specialization in artillery than just two decades earlier. Rates of fire increased along with greater accuracy and range. A plethora of smaller and more mobile projectiles made the life of the foot soldier ever more hazardous, even as he himself became ever more lethal. New technology also put into his hands the ability to take out tanks and artillery platforms themselves. If the infantryman was buffeted by howitzer, mortar, and rocket attack, in turn he sometimes had the means to destroy artillery, tanks, and other armored vehicles with shoulder-fired artillery, in effect through a single cheap shot, canceling out hundreds of man-hours of labor invested in armor and artillery production and training. The Germans produced both too many types of large artillery and, in aggregate, not nearly enough to fight on multiple fronts against the Allies. As was characteristic in World War I, Germany still pursued the evolutionary dead end of constructing huge, immobile Krupp railguns, capable of firing 5 to 7 ton projectiles with a range of 24 to 30 miles. As we have seen at the siege of Sevastopol, such behemoth 800mm, 31-inch, 1,500-ton guns, Gustav and Nora, proved largely wasted assets, given their slow rates of fire, immobility, enormous maintenance and transportation costs, and easy vulnerability to motorized infantry, tanks, and air power. Yet all that said, the Germans nevertheless produced the most practical and lethal artillery pieces of the entire war, some 20,000 88mm flak guns of numerous varieties. The Allies may have produced anti-aircraft guns with greater ranges than the 25,000 feet effective killing range of the German 88mm, and anti-tank guns with larger and more lethal calibers. But no gun in World War II was as versatile as the German 88mm. It could be set up in minutes, fire rapidly, 15 to 20 rounds per minute, had superb accuracy and easy sighting, and in theory could, with adjustments, alternate between targeting bombers or tanks. For the 2 years of Operation Barbarossa, the long and high-quality barrel of the 88mm offered about the only consistent German means for taking out Russian T-34 tanks. For just the cost of constructing two mostly irrelevant battleships, the Bismarck and Tirpitz, Hitler might have instead produced about 7,500 additional 88mm guns, well over half the number that were transferred from the Eastern Front to protect the German homeland from Allied bombers. Toward the end of the war, the Germans began installing great numbers of high-velocity, long-barrel, rapid-firing, and high-powered fixed 75mm assault guns on supposedly obsolete Mark III tank chassis. The resulting turretless but up-armored Sturmgeschütze IIIs were highly mobile, low-profile, and easily maintained anti-tank guns that survived on average 7 times longer on the Eastern Front than did late-model German tanks. Over 10,000 were built at costs far cheaper per unit than tanks. Even more impressive than the unique 88mm gun, the Germans finally saw the wisdom of mass-produced, cheap weapons as it turned out some 6 million Panzerfausts, tank fists. At close distances, these cheap, single-shot, disposable anti-tank weapons, in their final incarnations, proved deadly to most Allied tanks on either the Western or Eastern fronts. And when taken together with another 300,000 Panzerschrecks, tank frighteners, a German up-engineered copy of the American bazooka, single German soldiers often had the ability with an inexpensive weapon to knock out 30 to 40 ton tanks. German foot soldiers with such weapons probably took out 10% of all enemy tanks that were lost in the war, despite the late entrance, 1943, of the Panzerfaust in the war. The simple, reliable, cheap, and deadly Panzerfaust and Panzerschreck were the forerunners of the later rocket-propelled grenade, RPG, that likewise tended to level the playing field between sophisticated armor forces and poorly equipped foot soldiers. By 1943, the Wehrmacht's armor was outnumbered on every front, but its infantry's superior handheld anti-tank weapons and mines mitigated some of the consequences of that numerical imbalance. General Erhard Raus related how desperate German soldiers, on the retreat in winter 1945, often could disable or destroy Russian T-34 tank columns with simple, disposable Panzerfausts. The NCO knocked out the last tank with one Panzerfaust, whereupon the second tank turned toward the group of houses, firing as it moved toward the spot from which the tank commander presumed the resistance had come from. But using bushes as cover, the NCO had already crept up to the tank and from only a short distance knocked it out as well, using his second and last Panzerfaust. Russian infantrymen sometimes could likewise take out early model German tanks through use of their own anti-tank weapons. At Stalingrad, a Soviet major in a Russian rifle regiment related how one of his subordinates, a single shooter, Igor Mirohin, destroyed in succession 4 German tanks before being decapitated by a German tank shell. The Russians focused on the most effective infantry support weapons that they could build well and in great numbers, producing more artillery pieces and mortars than any other nation during World War II, perhaps four or five times as many as Germany alone. At the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, the Soviet Union, approximately 33,000 guns, already had over four times as many artillery units as the German invasion forces. And by war's end, the Soviets often enjoyed artillery superiority of 7-1, which mitigated the frequent loss in quality of Red Army replacement infantry units during the last 2 years of the war. Indeed, by 1945, it was not uncommon for particular Soviet offensives to muster over 40,000 artillery and mortar tubes, such as in January assaults on Silesia and East Prussia, and the final April assault on Berlin. Artillery was the sole category of weapon in World War II in which the Soviet economy roughly doubled the production of each of its other two major allies, Britain and the United States. Yet perhaps the most innovative artillery platform of the war was not even a barreled gun, but rather multiple self-propelled rockets or Katyushas, also known as Stalin organs. They were usually mounted in groups of 14 to 48 launchers on either trucks or tracked vehicles. Their advantages over artillery were chiefly ease and cost of production, given that there was no need for the precision craftsmanship required in making artillery barrels and shells. Even more important, the multiple and simultaneous launches of rockets resulted in a larger payload delivery with far less need for expertise and training in comparison to artillery, even if the Katyushas lacked the accuracy of traditional howitzers and large guns. The truck-mounted Katyushas could fire and leave from the launching site far more quickly than could even the most mobile artillery. Over 10,000 Russian Katyusha platforms were produced during the war, in calibers most commonly ranging from 82 millimeters to 300 millimeters. As in the case of the T-34 tank, the Germans were shocked that the supposedly less sophisticated Russians had deployed a completely new but effective weapon that was cheap, simple, and easy to use. As a general rule, emulation proved the best indication of weapon efficacy, just as Germans, British, and Americans eventually sought to copy many of the characteristics of the T-34 tank, so too the other belligerents rushed into production their own rocket batteries. As was also true of U.S. plane and tank production, the Americans soon produced standardized artillery platforms in enormous numbers. Perhaps the best were the light M2A 105mm and the longer-range M1 155mm howitzers. Both were mobile, accurate, and easily towed by trucks, or in the case of the 105mm, were occasionally self-propelled. In many ways, the motorized 105mm howitzer was the most versatile all-around infantry support gun of the entire war. But the real American contribution to artillery lethality was not to be found in artillery pieces per se, but rather in shells and a sophisticated system of targeting. Quite surprisingly, for an isolationist nation that had assumed air and naval power would project power abroad, the United States entered the war with the best system of synchronized artillery fire in the world, eventually to be known as a time-on-target, TOT, methodology that allowed different batteries in various locales to concentrate their fire on shared targets, resulting in near instantaneous arrivals of a variety of different types of shells from multifarious distances, thus catching enemy infantrymen unexpectedly and out in the open in the first vulnerable seconds of a huge barrage. Fire direction centers immediately behind the front coordinated radio requests from infantry and tanks for artillery support, and then allotted requisite artillery pieces while reviewing accuracy by forward spotters and light observation planes. Thus, America entered the war prepared to ensure that its greener soldiers were usually covered by artillery barrages more accurate and numerous than those of their enemies, and as effective as the far larger arsenals of the Soviet Red Army. By late 1944, most prominently at the Battle of the Bulge, U.S. forces were allowed to begin using top-secret new proximity fuse shells, theretofore limited largely to bombs, anti-aircraft shells, and artillery in the Pacific that could be reliably programmed to burst at predetermined heights above enemy targets, making it extremely difficult for troops to find safety from shrapnel in foxholes or field fortifications. These innovative radar-directed fuses had earlier proved particularly useful useful for American anti-aircraft batteries against kamikaze attacks in the Pacific, given that radio transmitters set off the explosives in the shell when they sensed a target roughly within a general pre-programmed distance. When used against land forces in Europe, the new proximity fuse shells showered shrapnel downward and shredded German troops in the way that even older preset proximity fuses had not. American artillery proved critical to the success of the GI. He entered the European and Pacific theaters with the least amount of military experience in comparison to the German, Italian, British, and Japanese soldier. And yet he was to be deployed in the most diverse theaters and at the greatest distances from his homeland of any combatant of World War II. The United States, also unlike Germany and Japan, did not have enough prior wartime experience to discover which of its pre-war assumptions about tactics and weaponry were valid, but instead sent its green troops head-to-head with those who drew on years of hardened campaigning from Poland to the Soviet Union to Manchuria. Without superior armor or air support in the early going, Americans relied on their artillery. It proved a great equalizer for American soldiers until they acquired greater expertise and reliable air cover. Japan was not known for either tank or artillery innovation. While the Japanese may not have designed the best mortars of the war and, in comparison to the Allies, produced them in limited numbers, they focused on types that were ideal for close-in fighting during the Pacific Island campaigns and in Burma. The Japanese Type 89 grenade launcher, also known as the knee mortar, although it was never to be fired from the knee, was a cheap substitute for artillery support and could fire a variety of generic Japanese grenades. Its lightweight, about 10 pounds, and easy assembly made it an ideal weapon for the dense brush, heavy rains, and fluid fronts of Pacific Island fighting, where even light artillery proved cumbersome and difficult to deploy. Quite different was the strange but more frightening 320mm Type 98 spigot mortar. It weighed about 675 pounds, and its barrels wore out quickly. But at a fraction of the cost of large artillery, it gave Japanese troops singular heavy artillery support in the same difficult terrain and weather. Historians understandably focus on landmark innovations in air and sea power and armor. The B-29 Superfortress bomber, the Essex-class carrier, or the T-34 or Tiger tanks. Less dramatic breakthroughs in time-tested technology such as artillery and rifles were not so romantic or heralded. Yet most soldiers were killed or wounded by either artillery in all its frightening manifestations or by small arms fire. In both categories, the Allies, and especially the Russians and the Americans, found almost immediate parity with, if not superiority over, their Axis enemies, despite the latter's terrifying all-purpose 88mm artillery piece, MG-42 machine gun, or the landmark STG-44 assault rifle. The huge imbalance between Axis and Allied artillery production in large measure explains why the vaunted German army could never compensate for its inferiority in air-ground support and vehicle production. Machines were not automatons. They had to be built, produced, and used by people who had a myriad of choices concerning their creation and application. The reason why the United States produced superb aircraft carriers and Germany did not reflected quite different policies enacted by Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Adolf Hitler and their respective advisors. Why the United States won the Battle of Midway was not just due to superior intelligence or luck, but is also explained by the respective admiralship of Admiral Raymond Spruance and Chuichi Nagumo. That British Prime Minister Winston Churchill did not order something as comparably foolish as the Axis surprise attacks on the Soviet Union and Pearl Harbor ultimately ensured that the Allied forces, not the Germans or Japanese, would win the war. The American worker could build a four-engine heavy bomber far more rapidly than a German or Japanese assembler could produce a medium two-engine bomber. The nature of leaders and the manner in which they mobilized their followers was every bit as important as scientific discovery and technological advance. The following four chapters of Part 6 return to the human themes of Part 1 that concerned the idea of leaders, elites, and the masses that prompted and shaped the conduct of the war. People as supreme leaders, warlords, and factory workers determined how their fellow citizens were armed, equipped, and led on the field of battle, decisions that in turn explained why and where 60 million died in World War II. Part 6. People. Leaders and followers, the living and the dead. Men are the city-state, and not walls nor ships empty of men. Thucydides. 16. Supreme Command. Over 15 million Russians and German soldiers perished on the Eastern Front because of Adolf Hitler's insistence on attacking the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin's naivete about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and his own initial paralysis in June and July of 1941. Without Hitler's manic commitment to go eastward, perhaps even die-hard Nazi generals would not have been able to convince their colleagues of the wisdom of Operation Barbarossa. And without Stalin's well-known paranoia, the Soviet general staff might have believed credible reports of Nazi deployments near the borders of Russia all through the spring of 1941 and made the necessary defensive adjustments. A single supreme mind in war, whether good or evil, can lead to millions of deaths incurred or avoided, in a way unrivaled by scores of subordinate generals and admirals. Italy and Great Britain were roughly similar in population in 1940. But had a Winston Churchill led Italy and a Benito Mussolini Great Britain, the wartime fates of both countries might have been quite different. The decisions of Neville Chamberlain and Edouard Daladier not to confront Hitler over the Anschluss or Czechoslovakia made more likely a European war in 1939 that would eventually lead to the deaths of 60 million over the next 6 years. President Harry Truman's determination to use the atomic bomb probably precluded the need for a far more costly invasion of Japan, and by abruptly ending the Pacific War limited somewhat Stalin's ambitions in post-war Asia. Mussolini himself was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Italians, Ethiopians, and Libyans in his fantasy attempts to create a new Roman Empire in North Africa with entirely inadequate forces. It is hard to imagine either Italian royalty or the general staff deploying and supplying almost a million Italian soldiers in the Balkans and North Africa in 1940 and 1941. Before the 20th century, the great captains like Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Frederick the Great, or Napoleon doubled as heads of state and senior commanders in the field. But with greater complexity in military affairs after the 19th century, even in dictatorial societies like Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, rarely did supreme military commanders, albeit sporting gold-braided hats and chests of medals, lead their troops into battle. Technological progress, especially the phone, telegraph, and radio, made it unnecessary that Hitler, in the leadership style of Frederick the Great on a horse, would invade Poland atop a Panzerkampfwagen Mark II scanning the front. Nor would Mussolini, who otherwise liked to ride horses, like a modern-day Caesar, trot through the snows of Albania. A head of state wearing a uniform in World War II did not translate into leading from the front, or knowing much of anything about tactics and strategy, or even earning all the gaudy medals on his chest. Sometimes wartime leaders are judged as beneficiaries of their political systems, in the manner that the Duke of Wellington gained advantage by answering to a parliamentary government, and Napoleon did not. Yet often an Epaminondas the Theban, Saladin or Kemal Ataturk succeeded or failed on his own exceptional merits and trumped the system that created him. Material and strategic resources often determine the fate of leaders. Give Hitler the industrial infrastructure of 1942 Detroit or the raw manpower of the Soviet Union and he might have fared better. For all of Hannibal's genius, Carthage drew on fewer assets than did the military of Republican Rome, which in the Second Punic War could survive the blunders of its many incompetent generals such as Flaminius, Sempronius, and Varro. Collective and shared ideas, not the individual men who champion them per se, are supposed to matter more in democracies, which supposedly create strategies by group consensus. Churchill, however, saved Great Britain in 1940, when probably few other democratic leaders could have, only to be unceremoniously voted out of office in July 1945, well before the close of World War II in the Pacific. At that moment, however, a dozen or so politicians easily could have completed Britain's successful efforts against Japan. Apparently, in extremis, a man like Churchill was irreplaceable. At better times, not so much. In democratic societies, few wish to concede that in times of crisis there are rare and irreplaceable leaders of the caliber of a Themistocles or Pericles, who alone tower over committees and coalitions of anonymous experts and politicians that are still competent enough to preserve what the singular leader has bequeathed them. An everyman Truman could take the place of a Roosevelt after April 1945 without disruption in the long-held Allied plan of action. Yet Truman probably lacked the eloquence and political skills and machinations to have readied America for war in 1940. Had Hitler or Mussolini died in 1942, Germany and Italy might well have found a leader who sought and obtained a negotiated surrender. Since antiquity, democracies have at least had the advantage of incorporating a broader participation in decision-making that can aid even a dynamic leader. A Churchill or a Roosevelt knowingly accepted that they had to be more sensitive to the public perceptions of success or failure, and that they had to deal with a number of brilliant advisers and rivals who were not shy in pointing out their shortcomings. In other words, they had to earn political legitimacy and always faced the audit of a fairly free government and press, and a host of rivals who wanted their jobs. That reality meant that once controversial policies were announced, the primacy of the European front over the Pacific or the demand for the unconditional surrender of the Axis powers, it was hard for the people to complain later that their elected representatives acted without consent of the governed. The upsides of keeping leaders honest and open to advice and criticism were sometimes offset by the downsides of a fickle majority, subject to demagoguery and sudden bursts of mob-like exuberance or outrage. Such democratic volatility was first and best recorded by the historian Thucydides during the debates over Athenian intervention in Mytilene, Milos, and Syracuse. The aristocratic historian noted that before and during the first years of the Peloponnesian War, the Athenian Pericles almost alone had successfully managed the strategic decision-making of radically democratic Athens, precisely because his personal clout allowed him extraordinary latitude that was rare in most volatile democracies. Whenever he saw them, the Athenian demos, unseasonably and insolently elated, Thucydides tells us, he would with a word reduce them to alarm. On the other hand, if they fell victims to a panic, he could at once restore them to confidence. In short, what was nominally a democracy was becoming in his hands government by the first citizen. Perhaps Thucydides was right that during existential conflicts like World War II, democracies run by a single powerful, though legitimate leader, become the most effective war makers. In a few hours after Pearl Harbor, an American electorate that had resisted many of Roosevelt's efforts to mobilize for war was suddenly demanding almost instant operations against the Japanese, with little memory of their own prior equally fervent isolationism. In response, Roosevelt increasingly began to rule, even more so than when engineering the New Deal, as first citizen, with a range of executive powers not normally associated with democracies, but reminiscent of the extraordinary and occasionally extra-constitutional powers of President Abraham Lincoln during the American Civil War. From 1939 to 1940, non-democratic dictators like Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and Joseph Stalin, as well as Hideki Tojo from October 1941 to July 1944, posed as adept strategists without much need for subordinates to second-guess their genius. Their Machiavellian diplomacy and preemptive attacks, without regard to public audit or legislative veto, were judged only by their results and so were initially considered by Germans, Italians, Russians, and Japanese to have enhanced their respective national interests at little cost. Dictatorship was the apparent wave of the future. For short, surprise border wars against the weak, strongmen often did not need to mobilize their entire economies or to craft a long-term agenda to win huge sacrifices from a wartime public. In contrast, the soon-to-be-extinct Western European democracies, the appeasing Great Britain and the isolationist United States, had all been confused and stymied by the rise of these single-minded dictators, Hitler in particular. The future Axis powers, as well as the Soviet Union, appeared resolute, determined, and calculating under the leadership of popular strongmen. Yet by early 1943, the very opposite had proven true. The dozens of bickering strategists that surrounded Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt seemed essential. Even the relatively unrestrained media of wartime America and Britain, and the requirement to articulate war aims in public speeches to Congress and Parliament, helped to audit military practices. In matters of total war and mass mobilizations, the need to court voters seemed to have given the surviving Democratic powers innate advantages over unstable and increasingly isolated Axis leaders cocooned in their bunkers and fortresses, and fearing the wrath of their own people as much as the enemy. Mussolini and Hitler, despite absolute rule, failed fully to mobilize the Italian and German wartime economies until late 1942 or even later. Churchill and Roosevelt, who operated under a system of checks and balances, quickly put their nations on a war footing. The authoritarians worried of the public consequences from shared sacrifice. The Democrats assumed a blank check to demand them, confident in the self-initiative and individual self-reliance of democratic culture. Hitler understandably rarely spoke to the German people after Stalingrad. Of the six major World War II leaders, only the Axis heads of state Hitler, Mussolini, and Tojo faced wartime assassination plots, many of them originating from their own militaries. Field Marshal and soon-to-be-relieved commander of Army Group South, Erich von Manstein, summed up how isolated his Führer had become. Hitler thought he could see things much better from behind his desk than the commanders at the front. He ignored the fact that much of what was marked on his far too detailed situation maps was obviously out of date. From that distance, moreover, he could not possibly judge what would be the proper and necessary action to take on the spot. An unpopular Mussolini was deposed after the successful Allied invasion of Sicily. After the loss of Saipan, Tojo was forced to resign as Prime Minister in July 1944, with a number of officers contemplating his assassination. The age-old problem with dictatorships, aside from the limited input from advisors and experts, was that the public could always tacitly and implicitly withdraw its support as news from the front grew ominous. Even, or rather especially, under autocracies, the people never feel accountable for their prior ecstatic allegiance to dangerous strongmen. They are never on record as formally approving risky national policies through free and transparent elections of such extremists in the first place. Even autocrat Joseph Stalin, in his forced flip-flop from Axis sympathizer to Big Three ally, discovered that the more military authority he delegated and the more flexible his command, the more the Red Army was likely to avoid the catastrophic disasters of the sort that had followed his top-down dictates between 1941 and 1942. The more successful he became in the eyes of his countrymen, so too might his failures be blamed on semi-autonomous subordinates. The stature of Marshal Georgi Zhukov rose with Stalin, even as the reputations of Field Marshals Guderian, Manstein, and Rommel waned in Hitler's eyes. Democracies vent palace dissent. Adversaries sought to dethrone Churchill or Roosevelt by leaks to the press, votes of no confidence in Parliament or attacks in Congress, or by running for office in 1944 or 1945. But to rid Germany of a dangerous Hitler or free Italy from Mussolini often seemed to require a gun or bomb, a fact well known to dictators. Finally, the presence of two democracies allowed the Allied Big Three to function in a way the authoritarian nations of the Axis could not. Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia could partner for only 22 months between August 1939 and June 1941, because each side logically suspected that the other would renounce its prior agreements. For a disparate alliance to succeed, it is advantageous that at least some leaders within it have obtained government office legitimately, and thus learned methods of holding power other than through brute force and prevarication. Stalin, for all his objections, privately accepted that he could trust Churchill and Roosevelt in a way that he, Mussolini and Tojo, never could Hitler. There really is no honor among unelected thieves. Fights were common among generals and planners, and they often included the Supreme Allied Command. Roosevelt and Churchill advanced harebrained schemes, but they listened to the objections against them. In contrast to the bickering of Allied politicians and generals, the Germans, from the man in the street to the chiefs of the German staff, never quite knew what nation Hitler would attack next or for what reason, only that it would be dangerous to second-guess even the most foolish of the Führer's directives. The same absence of discussion was almost as true of both Italy and Japan. In neither Rome nor Tokyo had there been clearly announced war aims to the public, not just because such states were closed societies, but also because almost all their military commanders themselves were not quite sure what Mussolini and Tojo and his advisers were intending, and usually dared not ask. Such praise of wartime consensual government is not to suggest that brilliant supreme leaders do not emerge from dictatorships, whether Alexander the Great or Napoleon. Philip II of Macedon exhibited brilliant military leadership lacking in the fickle and unprepared democratic Greek city-states. The ruthlessness and iron will of Joseph Stalin in large part explained the USSR's ability to surmount the difficulties in late 1942 of finishing the relocation of entire industries beyond the Urals, or to endure the losses at both Leningrad and Stalingrad without declaring an open city, forsaking any further defensive efforts. And there were plenty of mediocre elected leaders such as Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain or former French Prime Minister and later head of the Vichy government, Pierre Laval, who brought their democracies to near ruin. Constitutional leadership does not guarantee victory, as the Czechs, Danes, Norwegians, Dutch, Belgians, and French learned in 1939 and 1940, much less does it ensure that a pedestrian parliamentarian can be expected to trump a brilliant autocrat. Natural talent and the personal experience of a leader, regardless of particular political system, mattered as well. Adolf Hitler knew a great deal about the nature of infantry combat, as did Benito Mussolini and Winston Churchill. All three supreme commanders had fought in the front lines during World War I. For a while, Hitler's singular constitution bore up under responsibilities that would have killed most younger men. He clearly had uncanny psychological instincts about what drove men of power like himself and how to manipulate them accordingly.